Should we start?
Let's start.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a very special WonderCon Legal Geeks podcast presentation of Lawyers Go Batty Over the World's Greatest Detective from Gotham. Who could that possibly be? Thank you. Thank you. Already rabble-rousers. I am your moderator, Matt Weinhold. I am one of the cast members. Some of my fellow cast members are in the audience of the podcast Monster Party. Anyone ever hear of Smattering of Candy? All right, well, that's our panel. Let's move on. I also wrote on a cartoon. And I really, CGI is still considered a cartoon, right? Beware the Batman, anyone? It's not going well. Okay. But, so, Legal Geeks is a podcast, if you haven't listened to it, where lawyers, people in the legal field, involved with justice, real people, debate the kind of legal aspects of nerdy things. So, like Star Wars, the Marvel Universe, DC Universe, Land of the Giants, whatever you want to throw in there, I don't know. But this show is going to be about Batman. Let's have a round of applause for Batman, folks. Come on, let's get that energy up. And for the panel, we've got some, I would say, superheroes in the legal field. First of all, we have Steve Chu, Esquire, right? Is that how I say it?
That's fine.
Yes, thank you. He's assistant attorney, U.S. attorney in San Diego, who works on civil cases against the federal government. Please, let's give him a round of applause. He's also a giant fan of Star Wars and an avid toy collector. We need to talk. Out of the package, in the package, both.
Both, actually.
All right, there we go. That's the correct answer. Now, whoa! God. Our next guest we have is Jordan Huppert. Did I say that correctly?
Hoopert.
Much better. Esquire, a public defender in Eugene, Oregon, who is a fan of Green Lantern, Superman, and all things comics. Jordan is a guest blogger on Legal Geeks and has presented at multiple Comic Cons. So give him a round of applause, please. And next we have Courtney McNulty, Esquire, who is attorney for Legendary Entertainment, television division, where she gets to live out her dream working on nerdy shows like Lost in Space. She is also the co-host of Nerd In Out. No, Nerd In Out, not Nerd In Out. A nerd-based pop culture podcast. Please, let's give Courtney a giant round of applause. And finally, the host and co-creator of the Legal Geeks podcast, a podcast recognized by the American Bar Association as one of the best law blogs and podcasts in the country. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Joshua Gilliland. All right, let's get into this. Now, obviously, we need more than an hour to really cover the serious legal problems that are involved in the world of Batman. There are so many, but let's do the best we can in an hour. First up, Josh.
Josh,
how could the Gotham Police in the 1966 TV show Batman deputize vigilantes without violating the Constitution?
Thank you, Citizen Matt. Let's go back to a campier time. Sure, it's in the middle of the Cold War, and there were a few race riots, but deep down, we all loved each other. And in 1966, that magnificent work to art came to the big screen with Batman. Check it out. If you haven't seen it, it's a fun film. But in this early part of the movie, there's a press conference, and the evil Catwoman, doubling as a reporter, asks Batman to take off his mask during this press conference. And they tell her, no, we're not doing that. And Commissioner Gordon says, Batman and Robin are deputized. That's the only time that I that I know of that's appeared. Now, there's 80 years worth of content, so if someone says back in Detective Comics 92, I haven't read that, so... But this is one of the few times on the big screen where we actually have an acknowledgement of law enforcement deputizing Batman and Robin. So what's that mean? Well, in California, any qualified person can be deputized by law enforcement to help carry out law enforcement. And when that happens, that person has the authority as law enforcement to conduct law enforcement. Now, things get weird if Batman has to testify in court after an arrest. Because how can that person, Batman, swear on the record who he is? They would probably treat Batman as a confidential informant, like what we deal with undercover police officers. Now, we did a podcast during the Great Bat Jim arc in the Batman comics, and if you haven't checked that out, haven't read it, get the trade paperback. Bat Jim is the dad we deserve. And it can work. We did a podcast with a New York judge, and he went into great detail about how confidential informants work. And in this case, I think Batman would be very similar to a confidential informant, and they would probably have a different police officer effectuate the arrest, so that way that police officer could testify, reveal their identity, and that way we're not violating the Constitution with two masked vigilantes who happen to be deputies conducting law enforcement.
Okay. I still don't like it, though.
Don't worry, old chum. It's going to be okay.
All right. Okay, Steve. In The Dark Knight Returns, was Batman's vigilantism justified against the mutants? Is he a criminal?
So let's take a look at the next couple of slides here. Has everyone here actually read The Dark Knight Returns? One of the seminal Batman works by Frank Miller in 1986.
So nice animated version, too.
Very good, yeah. Right. And so this is a sort of dystopian future. Things have gone bad. And the heroes have sort of disappeared. And the story is about Batman coming back as an older man. And he's been gone for so long that the kids don't even think he really existed, that he's some just sort of... this sort of myth at that point. The movie The Dark Knight, or rather The Dark Knight Rises, kind of pulls a lot from that comic. In the comic, when we're trying to find out what happened to the heroes, Superman appears, and then he mentions that at some point the heroes were all called in front of a congressional subcommittee, and Batman is asked a question, to which he responds, "Of course we're criminals. We've always been criminals. We have to be criminals." And of course, that doesn't do a lot for his popularity, but it basically drives the heroes underground. You have Batman admitting, yes, we are absolutely criminals. We just happen to be criminals that you like because we're fighting the bad guys. So we also find out in the next slide, Superman is actually able to operate. Why? Because they give him a license. Also, he saves lives. He gets to save lives. But most importantly, he stays quiet. He doesn't question the government. He's basically a government lackey, and so he and Batman don't get along very well anymore. Batman says, why are you doing this? You're sold us out, essentially. And Batman is driven underground. So, yes, he's absolutely a criminal by his own admission. However, in the story, you have a violent, fearsome group of young gang members called the Mutants, and they're led by this really powerful guy who's almost like a Bane type of character. Batman has to fight him, and at the point where they fight, we accept Batman being a vigilante, being a hero, because at that point the police has essentially failed. Not only that, but we also have the mayor has been killed after trying to sit down with the mutant leader and try to negotiate like a wartime type of conference. There's civil unrest, the government is starting to fall apart, the citizens don't know what to do, and it's really a wartime type of situation. So when you look at situations like that, and we see these type of arguments to justify a lot of government or extreme police action whenever you have times of war, times of terror, things like that we've heard probably more since 9/11, but Batman is basically, he cuts a deal with Gordon, and Gordon says, go get them, essentially. So Batman faces the mutant leader. I won't spoil the story for those of you who have not read it. I would definitely suggest everyone if you're a Batman fan, this is definitely one of the must reads. But Batman becomes a champion of Gotham. So at least in that moment, yes, he's a criminal, but we accept him. Now, if we look at the law, and the courts really have spoken on this, the law really frowns on vigilantes. The Supreme Court, both of the United States and of California, both said that. There are a lot of concerns here, and really this is far more than we can go into in 1 hour. But the thing about vigilantes is, number one, what if they actually get the wrong person? You know, they think they've got the right person, but they don't. Now, in a comic, oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, the reader gets to see who the real criminal is. So you know who deserves the punishment. And then you watch and read as the hero tries to track down the criminal. But in real life, oftentimes, we just don't know, even up until the very end. So that's a real concern. What if we get the wrong person? You know, additionally, there's this real check and balance issue, which is the police have to answer to someone. They have to answer to the public. They have to answer to the government, the mayor, the president. They aren't just running around without a license. They have to train and they have to become deputized. Now, with the heroes, it's that saying, who watches the watchers? That's been explored in another 86 seminal work, The Watchmen. But basically, who do the superheroes answer to? To whom do they answer? In Marvel, they kind of explain that, where the Avengers have a UN charter for a while, but then they kind of fight against that. In The Dark Knight, you know, they talk about it. Well, who would the superheroes answer to? Superman agrees to answer to the president and some of the government, but Batman and the others refuse. And the stories, this issue is explored more fully in another seminal work, Kingdom Come, but we'll come to that in a little bit.
And not to jump ahead, but I would think there's always going to be a problem when you have a secret identity.
Right, yeah.
Because who are you going to hold responsible?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, for just really quickly, you know, if, let's say Batman hurt someone, and if you were a policeman, the policeman could be sued for hurting someone. If it's Batman, who do you sue? You know, you try to sue Batman. But if you know his secret identity, well, now you've got Bruce Wayne and his many billions. So you got a deep pocket. You could have people actually just claiming that they've been assaulted by Batman to try to, you know, cash in on the lottery or whatnot. But there's just another huge, you know, series of topics there.
Okay. Okay, Josh. Could suspects apprehended by Batman sue Commissioner Gordon for excessive force? He's kind of rough on the criminals.
The answer is a solid maybe. And it all depends on whether or not Batman is a state actor. Because if he's a state actor and, say, deputized, he has to follow the Constitution. So there could be excessive force claims if he's causing spinal cord injuries, dropping mobsters off roofs, and all of that. That's excessive force. So the issue then turns, when Commissioner Gordon uses the bat signal, does that turn Batman into a state actor? And the answer is, if I were a plaintiff attorney or a criminal defense attorney, I would argue yes. And if I were the DA, I would say no.
Don't you love law?
Yeah. And then some poor judge has to go, and figure out the right answer. But I would tend to believe, if a state actor, then yes. Now, the part of the ambiance of Batman is having some deniability on the police part, because things are out of hand with the, you know, villains in Gotham, which is why Batman's needed, because law enforcement's right. Inadequate. But I would definitely think it's tending towards a 1983 action could be brought for excessive force if he goes too far.
But he kind of always goes a little too far, doesn't he?
It depends on the writer.
Okay. Okay, so...
So the question is, wouldn't Commissioner Gordon want to protect Batman? Yes, definitely. And we'll take questions at the end from the mic, so thanks for bringing that up now. So,
lawyer. No. Want to be, okay.
Just smart.
All right, here we go. Now, the Batmobile has always confounded me in many ways when it comes to anything legal. But we're looking at, this is...
Batman Begins.
Batman Begins. He's driving all over the place. He's driving on rooftops. Does reckless driving on rooftops, obviously that's got to be against the law.
Yes.
But forget about that. I mean, let's go back to just the Batmobile. You've got an unregistered car.
Yep.
Nope. Not street legal in any way.
Nope.
Certainly not smog, right?
Nope.
You saw the flame coming out of the back. It's a disaster. Josh, help me.
It is. So when looking at California law, our laws are written for driving on highways or off-street parking facilities. And he starts in an off-street parking facility before hopping rooftop to rooftop to get back onto the freeway. So there's a whole list of moving violations in addition to not responding to the police officers, because if the lights and sirens are behind you, you are supposed to stop. So
how about trespassing?
Yeah, because of going on rooftops.
You're not allowed to bring your car on the roof.
Nope. All bad. The insurance claims for that would be super messy.
Might as well just buy a Corvette.
Okay.
Right?
No.
Okay, Courtney.
Yes.
Okay. In the film The Dark Knight, can Wayne Enterprises be sued for invasion of privacy, and this is a great question, for hacking all the cell phones in Gotham?
Yes.
Thank you.
Next slide. Yeah.
We have the clip.
You have a little clip for you, yes.
If the audio were on. Wait, let's do that.
What?
We don't have the audio tech in the back.
Just pretend he's saying something along the lines of, You're using my sonar to hack into the cell phones of 30 million people in Gotham. And obviously, Mr. Fox has a problem with that. But is it illegal or is it just morally wrong?
According to Edward Snowden, it's definitely illegal.
Yes. Unfortunately, according to the laws of the federal government and the state of California and the state of New York, it is not legal. They violated both federal and state laws by using the system to spy on 30 million people. They violated the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. Now, a lot of people think that, oh, they need a warrant to listen in on people's cell phones, but unfortunately, Wayne Enterprises is a private establishment. They're not part of the government. They don't need a warrant or anything like that. They just, need the right tech. But the Electronic Communications Privacy Act is defined in federal law as a non-consensual acquisition by electronic, mechanical, or other surveillance device, which this sonar machine would be, the contents of any wire or electronic communication, under circumstances in which a party to the communication has a reasonable expectation of privacy. A reasonable expectation of privacy is just what an ordinary person would think, am I having this conversation, in private, or is somebody listening to me?
Not given to Batman, is what you're saying.
Right, exactly. Right. Do I think Batman's listening to me? If you do, then you don't have a reasonable expectation.
Of Wait a second. Batman's always
listening. That's pretty funny. Okay. All right. Under federal law, it's a crime to wiretap or use a machine, such as Fox's sonar machine, to capture the communications of others without court approval unless one of the parties gives their consent. So I did two states, California, because is a two-party consent state, which means both people that are part of the conversation have to approve having their conversation listened in on or recorded. New York is a one-party consent state. So one party just has to say, sure, you can record it. Unfortunately, here, no parties consented because Batman just said, what the hell, he's going to go ahead and listen to everybody anyways. So they, in the end, although the computer system was destroyed, they definitely violated a lot of civil liberties and a lot of laws. And unfortunately, I think Wayne Enterprises, should everyone find out, they'll be subject to a lot of civil lawsuits. And as he pointed out earlier, there's some deep pockets, so there'll be a lot of money going to 30 million people of Gotham if they found out their conversations were listed on it. Of course, we'd argue exigent circumstances. We really needed to find out where this Joker was to save lives, but unfortunately, I don't think John Smith is going to care if he can get a couple million dollars out of that.
No, go back to actually being a millionaire.
Yeah.
Okay, Jordan. In The Dark Knight, the movie, did it make sense for Batman to take the fall for Harvey Dent's crimes?
So, there are two answers you'll get if you ask a lawyer any question. The first is, let me do some research on that. The second is, it depends. So the answer to the question is, it depends. It depends on what Batman's aim was. If his aim is to help his buddy Harvey Dent avoid some messy publicity, then yeah. yeah, it makes sense for him to do that. It provides the police a scapegoat. Not that they can already have a better one than Joker, but we'll shuffle that over there for a bit. If his aim is to protect Harvey from some kind of legal trouble, then no, it probably doesn't make sense for him to do that. There are enough witnesses at this point, there are enough people who, and then there are enough people who know kind of Batman's mystique, his legend at this point, that he doesn't go around wantonly killing people, that it doesn't make a whole lot of sense why anybody would think that Batman did this. The legal case, if they decided to bring it, we'd be okay. But you also wonder if they decided to bring it. Full disclosure, I do public defense work, so I don't... The government is not my most trustworthy source. There is a real question whether or not the police would decide to bring an investigation into the actions of this beloved district attorney, Harvey Dent, who just ran a huge district attorney campaign on let's take back this city. So it depends on why Batman was doing it. Now, the other interesting thing about this, and this may just be me griping, but you have this character in Batman who starts off in Batman Begins saying, I'm going to take down this corrupt Falcone, the corrupt mobster who's bought out the system and become higher in the courts. He's going to right all the wrongs and make it so the system functions again. And then in the second movie, he says, screw the system, you're my buddy. So ultimately, I think the answer is no. It doesn't make sense for him to do that in any kind of legal or character-driven sense.
All right. Okay, everybody. This next one. What we've all been thinking about for years. Considering the relationship between Batman and Robin the Boy Wonder. Child and Dick. Anyone?
So I have been voluntold that this is my topic. This is a topic that could also span an entire hour,
yes.
If not weeks or months.
Yes.
For all the minors in the audience who are thinking about a superhero sidekick career, I would say please be careful.
No, please don't.
Unless you have actual superpowers, maybe. But
my uncle works out. Let's go fight crime.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So you can't have Batman without Robin, at least in the public consciousness. That's how Batman has become famous, through Adam West, through the various movies, the comics. Even though he did debut, as a solo character, eventually Robin came in pretty quickly. And we know Batman and Robin as sort of the quintessential team-up. But the big problem is Robin is typically underage. Now, we can debate that a little bit there. When you look at the comics, there have been several different Robins. A great trivia would be if anyone can name each and every one of those. Maybe we'll get to that in a little bit. But here we're talking about the Dark Knight Returns again, and he has an underage, under 18, that is, girl named Carrie Kelly who joins him and takes on the Robin mantle. So at this point, again, Robin has become this larger-than-life character who is not owned by one person. It's a mantle that has been passed on to different people. Carrie Kelly being the latest entry here in the Dark Knight Returns. And within that comic itself, at one point, the new police commissioner is chasing Batman. They spot that there is a child, Robin, with Batman, and Yindle, the commissioner, says, let's add child endangerment to the charges against Batman. Let's take a look at the elements here. Without getting overly technical, basically the issue is what the law says, if you willfully cause or basically allow the child to be placed in danger where their health or their body, their person is threatened, then that's a problem. Or, of course, if you yourself directly threaten that child. One interesting wrinkle in this law is that the child does not actually have to be harmed. It's enough that the child is placed in danger. So let's take a look at what happens, and maybe we can actually answer this question just by walking through this. What do Batman and Robin do? They jump off rooftops. They engage in close quarters combat with opponents who are often armed, and inexplicably they always get away from that. But they also pilot armored vehicles in the combat situations. So I think that any reasonable jury or judge would probably say that these are relatively dangerous situations. So if Batman were ever hauled into a court of law and there would be many charges against him, child endangerment would probably be lower on the list. But I think he would be in a lot of trouble. I would certainly not want to be the lawyer defending Batman at this point. I think you would just want to pull the fire alarm and just make everyone run from the courthouse. So that might be your best defense at that
point. I couldn't play with matches. Are you kidding me?
That's right. Right, yeah. Pull the fire alarm and have Batman put out the fire and then get in trouble again, right?
Wow. They still have to prove it was Batman under the hood.
That's right. Thinking like a true public defender.
All right. Well, this is, I guess, adjacent to this topic, which is, in the controversial Batman comic, A Death in the Family, what is Batman's liability for the death of Robin?
So, if you need to forever alter comic history with the death of a character, you call Jim Starlin. And this was, for those who weren't around at this point in time, they actually had a 900 number to call in to vote.
Yeah.
No, but we were reading at that point in time, and it was September of 1988, and it overlapped with my birthday of voting, and I think the vote was only like off by 70. So it was a super close vote, and they wrote Robin in such a way, and this is Jason Todd, that people found him obnoxious. And Jason had a lot of issues because his parents were killed, and then he found out who he thought was his mother wasn't his mom. And he ultimately learns that there were three women who could be his mom, and they're all hiding out in the Middle East, and one's a Mossad agent, so he goes off on this adventure, and Batman is on missions with him and going like, the kid's losing it. So we're going to have to bench him because he's super upset all the time and doing super dangerous activities. So Batman tries to, you know, keep him off the field, and Robin goes rogue because Bruce Wayne set up his ward with all kinds of credit cards enough so he could book a flight to Israel. So what happens? The high level, he books a flight. Batman goes to the Middle East because Joker has a nuclear missile he's going to sell to make money. So there's weird geopolitical issues in the story as well. They find the Joker. Joker gets away. They travel to Ethiopia to find candidate 3 for Jason's mom. Jason learns that mom is being blackmailed and working with the Joker. Batman goes off to stop some of the Joker's men, tells Jason to wait. Jason decides to take on Joker by himself. Kid. After his mom sells him out to the Joker, he's beaten to death. And then a bomb goes off and he jumps on the bomb to save his mom. So he dies a hero. Mom dies too. But is Batman responsible? Yeah! Absolutely! You take a kid who's unstable and you teach him how to fight crime and hope it's all going to work out okay, and you arm him with credit cards so he can go wherever the hell he wants.
And also, minus all that other stuff that you were just mentioning, isn't every teenager just a tad unstable?
Yeah, because growing up's hard.
Yes.
But it's harder when your parents have been brutally murdered. So
he's got a point.
Yeah, it does. So, and then you find out you've been living a lie. So he has a rough time. And Bruce Wayne arguably enabled him and put him into that dangerous situation. So, now Grant, this story is great. The following story that takes place, A Lonely Place of Dying, highly recommend it. I'm sure there are comic book vendors downstairs that have these in trade paperback. If you haven't read it, go check them out because this is why we're here and it's a great story.
Yeah. And speaking of great stories, okay, I don't know if you guys have read the Grant Morrison classic, Arkham Asylum.
Wait.
The full title is, huh?
Let's do The Grinning first with the animated series.
Oh, okay. All right, let's do that instead.
So Courtney.
Can the Joker's grin be copyrighted?
Again, no. I feel like I'm the typical lawyer, so I'm saying no, you can't do that. But no, you can't do that. So this is kind of an odd topic, one of the Joker's weirdest ideas. He wanted to copyright his brain. He did this by dumping a toxin into Gotham City's bay, and all of the fish came out deformed with these creepy grins that looked exactly like the Joker's. So the Joker went into the copyright office and said, I want to copyright my grin, and you're going to do it or die. So the copyright office employee says, you can't copyright a fish, they're a natural resource, which is an odd thing to say, but it's true. You can't copyright a natural resource. You can't copyright a living organism or genetically modified DNA. I mean, you can apply for a patent for certain plants, but that's not what we're talking about here. So a copyright is the exclusive legal right to reproduce, publish, sell, or distribute the matter and form of something, such as literary works, musical, or artistic work. And this work has to be in a tangible form. So of course you could argue the fish is a tangible form. I can pick up this fish and it has this creepy grin on it. But there's going to be some issues because no one is reproducing this work. The fish reproduce themselves. I'm not going to go into how that works. I think we all know. So the fish reproduce themselves. So the fishermen are just catching these fish. The first sale doctrine guarantees that you have the right to give away, sell, or otherwise dispose of legally obtained copyrighted work. So these fishermen go in and they legally obtain these fish with the grin on them, and then they decide to sell them. They're allowed to do that according to the first sale doctrine. So if the fishermen, sushi chefs, citizens, they wouldn't be breaking any element of copyright law, so who would the Joker even be suing for this anyways? So even if the copyright office people were, you know, bullied into giving him the copyright, he wouldn't make a dime off of this. I think that the Joker would have had better luck trying to copyright his makeup because, it, you know, certain makeup, like clowns actually can copyright their makeups, different designs and stuff like that.
Kids?
There you go. Not a clown, but clownish makeup. So you can copyright that stuff. You could also do a trademark. A trademark is a word, phrase, symbol, or design, the makeup, that identifies and distinguishes the source of the goods. So there's no confusing that creepy red grin from anyone else. So there's definitely no doubt who the source would be. So if the Joker really wanted to make some money, I think that his best bet would have been to try to trademark it, slap it on a t-shirt, and sell it, because this weird fish theory we had going on isn't going to pan out for him.
All right. Okay, so during the story, Cataclysm and No Man's Land, earthquakes, Gotham City has gone through a lot. And then later on, there was even a contagion. So during this cataclysm, did Nightwing and Catwoman have a duty to rescue victims?
Short answer, no, though they didn't. The law doesn't impose special duties on random everyday citizens, even if they put on masks and costumes, are not under any obligation to help anybody. That's why we have the Good Samaritan laws that protect people who do take that kind of special step to try to help people. Because you're not legally bound to do that. Nightwing, Catwoman, Batman, Superman, anybody. This morning they had the memorial of Stan Lee, and I thought, an interesting quote to put in here is his, and that person who helps others simply because it should or must be done, because it is the right thing to do, is indeed, without a doubt, a real superhero. So that's what they're doing. They're not under any special obligation, legal or otherwise, to do it. They're doing it because it's the right thing to do.
Isn't it sort of like the other side of the coin of being a vigilante, too, which is that, you know, you're fighting crime to help people, but if you're rescuing someone, you could also somehow put them in even more danger?
Well, there are special circumstances that don't really go going into in any great depth that require you to, if you're going to undertake that step to save somebody, to do it with some reasonable care. Like if you're going to perform CPR on somebody, you have to perform CPR well. If you don't, then you might be liable for damages. Okay. So you can go into that, but
okay.
But ultimately the answer to the question is no, they don't have any obligation to do that.
Okay, so now we're talking about the classic Grant Morrison, Arkham Asylum. Now, in this story, did Arkham Asylum violate Harvey Dent's Eighth Amendment rights by taking away his coin? They took away his coin!
And it made him a mess. So they then give him dice and then tarot cards to help deal with this obsession of duality. And when the inmates take over the asylum, Batman finds Harvey Dent under a desk playing with cards. He's wet his pants because he can't decide to go to the bathroom because he doesn't have his coin. So, putting on my plaintiff lawyer hat of like, dude, that's evil, don't do that, that's my two cents on it. Now, we then have to get into the tests. Now, if you follow our podcast, at San Diego Comic Fest 3 weeks ago, we did a mock trial with law students on this issue. And they forgot a key thing in the arguments. You can listen to we posted it. They did great arguments, but they forgot one key fact. Dr. Cavendish turns the asylum into a giant trap for Batman. Arguably, all the treatment there was bad because everything was designed to fail. So I would have nailed my flag to that banner for that argument. But the legal test is, was Harvey Dent's treatment deliberately indifferent to his medical needs? Dr. Ruth Adams saw what was happening to him, admits that it's experimental treatment, and keeps doing it. I don't think she was in the right. Now, ultimately, I think a jury should decide this, especially when you look at all the other facts that take place and the fact that she has to kill Cavendish in order for Batman to escape because Cavendish is trying to kill Batman. Arkham is a bad, bad place. You look at the lawsuits from the 1970s on asylums, you could see where this is inspired from, but it's definitely, I think they violated his civil rights.
Okay, 1989, the Tim Burton Batman film. The Joker gets some, dare I say, questionable plastic surgery. Does the Joker have a medical claim for malpractice?
So this is an interesting question, and I guess the short answer would be that we can't say for sure, but it's unlikely. And the reason why it's difficult to say for sure is because we don't have a lot of facts. All we have is we see the Joker, Jack Napier, fall into the vat of acid, and then a few scenes later we see him in this sort of underground clinic with his doctor who, I think it's safe to assume he's not licensed, he's practicing underground, you know, with dirty equipment. And he treats the Joker tears off his bandages and starts laughing. So it's a very memorable scene. And the doctor pleads with the Joker, who begins smashing his equipment. The doctor says, please, you see what I have to work with here. So at that point, can the Joker sue the doctor and say, Doc, you screwed up, you messed me up? In legal parlance, there are two things that the plaintiff must prove in a medical malpractice action. One, the legal parlance is they have to show that the physician or medical provider breached the standard of care. In common terms, basically, you have to prove that they did something wrong. And then second, you have to prove that the wrongdoing then led to the harm that the patient suffered. Now, what makes this question difficult here is that we don't really know why the Joker went to this doctor. Did he go to the doctor to keep him alive? You know, was the Joker having trouble breathing, something like that? If so, then the doctor really hasn't done anything wrong. The Joker's alive. He walks out of there and he's more dangerous than ever. If it was an elective procedure, some sort of plastic surgery, Joker says, I just want to look different, look better, get a nose job, get a mouth job, something like that. I mean, I suppose, you know, he might have a better chance, but the plaintiff, the Joker would have a real hard time trying to find some precedent because I don't think there's been any comparable medical procedure done in medical history that we know of. So I think the Joker would have a real uphill battle.
Yeah. If you ever watched the show Botched, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, keeping with the 1989 Batman film, what crimes did the Joker commit that we can get him on?
Since the legal term was a crap ton. So there's a lot of crime committed in every single Batman movie, but I think you'd be surprised to know that there were the most deaths in the 1989 Batman, there were the most murders, there's about 58. So, although the Joker didn't commit all of those, he did commit a lot. In the beginning of the movie, I don't know if you guys remember, but when he was a young man, he actually was the one who murdered Thomas and Martha Wayne. He poisoned a bunch of people. He had a Smilex, which was a poison gas that made people laugh themselves to death with that creepy grin on their face. So he poisoned a couple of models with that. He poisoned a news reporter with that. He shot some mob bosses. He poisoned all of the civilians at the Guggenheim Museum. He let some gas out into the museum and he poisoned them. And everyone remembers the memorable, I hope, scene of when he electrocuted Antoine Telly with that buzzer that he had. I remember when I was a kid, I wanted one of those so bad, and I mean, that says a lot about me, but I thought that was pretty great. A lawyer, even if she wanted a buzzer that electrocuted someone, I bet.
Antoine got a little hot under the collar, right?
He also shot Lieutenant Max Eckert. Now, I put that one under manslaughter because if you remember, Max was sent to murder the Joker, so he would have a solid self-defense claim, so I don't think it would be straight-up murder. He also kidnapped a couple people. There was a hostage in the Smilex commercial that came on that was bound and gagged. We don't know who that was, that poor guy, but he was kidnapped. He also kidnapped Batman's love interest, Vicki Vale. And he attempted to murder all of the citizens of Gotham by poisoning them with the Smilex gas at this parade. He wanted to everyone to die. You can see why this, it didn't look like the darkest Batman, but this Joker was probably the most twisted, in my opinion. He just wanted everybody dead. And then one thing I don't understand why he did, but he kind of just did it to stick it to everyone else in Gotham. He destroyed all of the art at the Guggenheim Museum. So if you lived, you didn't get to appreciate any beautiful art because the Joker destroyed it all. So there was a ton of crime in the 1989 Batman.
And yet William Barr says, total vindication. Well, some from Jews.
Okay. So in the Batman Beyond series, his mind is, Mr. Freeze's mind is put into the body of a manufactured body. And so does that negate him having to have access to his money? In short, what happens to Mr. Freeze's money in that show?
So, shout out to my favorite Batman series. If you remember the episode, Mr. Freeze is being experimented on by the bad guy Blight, and see blah, blah, blah. Not really the point here. What the point is that Mr. Freeze decided to turn over a new leaf after getting the DVD body. He says, well, I have this money that was put in a blind trust before I went to prison, taken from my legitimate holdings, and I want to start this charity with it for naming for my wife Nora Freeze. Question is, do you get to have a blind trust with legitimate holdings after being a super criminal, bank robber, monster guy? And putting aside for a moment the fact that when we first meet Mr. Freeze in Batman the Animated Series, he's embezzling money from his employer, oddly enough, was by marketing, and he can't afford to keep up the treatments on his wife, so did he ever actually have any legitimate holdings at any point after he came to Freeze and cut out the air? Assuming he did, what would happen to those? And the answer is, there's this thing in the law called criminal forfeiture, which basically means if you commit crimes, the government gets to go after everything you own that was derivative of those crimes, not just the money you stole, the cars you needed that money to buy, anything that they can tie directly or indirectly to the proceeds of that criminal activity, they get to go after and seize. So it would be a decidedly uphill battle for Mr. Freeze to show with any degree of certainty that he had any real legitimate holdings with which to start this blind trust. The answer is probably no. And the government gets there.
Fair enough.
So, all right, this is the one I think that I've been wanting to know the answer to. Yeah. So, right, is there any way that we would know by now
that Bruce Wayne is Batman?
I think Commissioner Gordon would have figured it out at some point.
By looking at the guy in the mask and going, hey, is that Bruce Gordon or Bruce Wayne?
Yeah. If not, he's a really, really bad detective.
Yeah. I know you're doing a gravelly voice, but I think you're Bruce Wayne.
That chin, something about...
Something about that dimple.
Yeah. Now, is it in his interest to say, hey, I think you're Bruce Wayne? No, it's not. So, I think he's just calling a mulligan.
But how about everybody else, though? Everybody else in the world who goes, I think that's Bruce Wayne.
I think it depends how much press coverage there is of Batman that... If he's operating at night in the dark, are there good photos of him?
There's well, considering the day and age that we live in, everybody's got a camera, right? And that somebody would have some sort of footage of him for a second taking off the mask and scratching, you know?
Maybe. It would depend how careful he was, and if he was shrouded in darkness all the time, that could help hide his identity.
It definitely doesn't improve Gordon, though, to be able to say on the road that he doesn't.
Yeah.
Okay, that's true. So
there is an element of political likeness.
Yep.
But you would think like every investigative journalist, TV show, everybody would be after that story.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I proved. Okay. So in the comic series Kingdom Come, why was there not a guilty verdict for the Joker's murder?
So this is another one of the Elseworlds stories in the DC universe, one of those hypothetical stories, sort of what could happen, what if. In this version, it's a story put together by Mark Waid, the writer, Alex Ross, the legendary artist, in 1996. I'm presuming some folks here most likely have read Kingdom Come. But Kingdom Come takes place in the future, another sort of dystopian future where the heroes have vanished. And they ask us the question, which a lot of readers have asked for many years, why doesn't a hero just kill the Joker? And if you kill the Joker, you stop him from inevitably escaping from prison, breaking out, killing people in that process, coming up with another evil plot, killing many other innocent people, and before being captured and sent back to prison and, you know, rinse, wash, and repeat. So why not break that cycle simply by killing the Joker? And so that's actually what happens. If we want to take a look then. What happens in this version is that the Joker goes to Metropolis, takes over the Daily Planet, kills many people, including Lois Lane. Superman tears up the town looking for the Joker, but one of the new heroes at this point, who is named Mad God, finds the Joker first. The Joker has been arrested, and rather than proceeding and trusting the system, like Superman would do, Mad God actually just guns him down in cold blood with his weapon in front of dozens of witnesses. So the Joker's dead, problem solved, right? Well, then we move on to the next part, which is Mad God is then put on trial for murder. And under the law, he is unquestionably guilty. He has killed someone in plain sight with dozens of witnesses. There's really no legal defense that he has. However, he is acquitted. And the reason is a phenomenon known as jury nullification. What that means is that in a jury trial, the jury can actually disregard or nullify the law to reach the result that they wish. Now, this has historically happened. It can happen occasionally. It doesn't happen very often. But the law actually recognizes that this is a possibility. In a sense, the jury is taking the law into their own hands. It should be emphasized, I mean, this doesn't happen a lot. It typically happens in favor of acquittal, that is, that they will find an alleged murderer not guilty. It doesn't usually happen the other way, where they say, well, we don't care about the evidence, we just think this guy did it, so we're going to convict him. Generally doesn't happen that way. It can, but it's rare. And just to show, once again, our judicial system's balance, the judicial system is favored in terms of individual liberty. The question that is asked often in law school is, would you rather a guilty person go free or lock up an innocent person? And the justice system answers that for us. Because of the presumption of innocence, we would rather a guilty person go free rather than lock up an innocent person. So in this case, Mad God is acquitted. It is blatant jury nullification. Superman then loses faith in the system, and he retreats and just goes off on his own. He turns his back on humanity. Now, the problem with this, as we asked a moment ago, problem solved. You killed the Joker. Everything's fine now, right? Well, actually, what we find out is that Magog, because of his disregard for life, and he thinks he's the champion now because the people have spoken. They wanted him to kill the Joker. He feels vindicated. But he also has a disregard for human life. And because of that, in later confrontations, he's not careful to protect the innocents around him. And it leads to a disaster where they chase down a fugitive. The fugitive lashes out, tries to surrender, but they won't accept the surrender. The heroes led by Magog will not accept the surrender. And in the process, in the scuffle, one of the heroes named Captain Atom is ripped open and creates a nuclear holocaust that levels the entire Midwest. Tons of people are killed, and that's pretty much the end of that. I know we're towards the end here.
We're done.
Okay, we're done.
So, follow us on social media. Thank you all for attending one of the last cons of the day, and have a wonderful weekend. Thank you.
And listen to Monster Party. With Sean Sheridan, Larry Stroken, James Jonas, and myself, Matt Weinhold. Available where all podcasts are available. iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher.
I'm going to keep talking.